Taped from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hey, Darren. How you doing?
Doing well, sir. Doing well. Happy 4th to you and yours. Yeah.
We're recording this on the 4th of July, so...
America.
Yay?
Yay? Yeah. But it's not us being all... despondent and down on our country, because we have a guest here to join us too. We have a good friend, Mr. John Minus. Mr. Minus, how are you, good sir?
Hello, I am great.
Yeah, John Minus. He has been on the podcast before. He spoke with us before about James Gunn's The Suicide Squad a couple years ago, and he has a periodic comedy show called Geeks of Wrath. And we're very happy to have him back. Thank you, John.
Yes, it's great to be here. It is it is swamp-like.
Yes.
Yes. And we're in a sweltering summer here in the Northeast.
The East Coast has turned to Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. And
we're already a swamp, so.
Yes.
This is true. Yeah, we do have swamplands, so.
Absolutely.
Last week, Like a few days ago, we hit the 100th birthday for the great Mel Brooks. Love that he made it to 100. And we started racking our brains. I was like, gee, can we do anything for Mel Brooks's 100th birthday? Because that's an event we really want to celebrate.
Yeah, we already put out the episode, the Man of the Year episode for the America's 250th. But this is where... This is the true event we really want to celebrate, the 100th birthday of the great Melvin James Kaminsky, a.k.a. Mel Brooks.
Nice, nice. And so, we started racking our brains. I was like, okay, has he ever done anything with an SNL alum? And I realized at first, I was like, oh, right, yeah, Will Ferrell was in the producer's movie. And Darren, I think you realize that Pamela Stevenson from the 80s cast at SNL, she was in this movie that we're covering today, History of the World Part 1. So we decided to let the people weigh in on what they wanted us to watch, because we couldn't really favor one or the other.
That's right.
And most of the responses we got were saying History of the World Part 1, History of the World Part 1. And then when John heard that we were going to do History of the World Part 1, he says let me guess. So
John Minus chimed in. You had to be a part of this. So before we start off, what's your connection to this movie? What made you reach out to us and be like, I have to be part of this episode?
Well, I think I got most of my sense of humor from Mel Brooks movies, and especially this one, because they used to show it on Channel 11 once a month, and it was... It wasn't heavily edited, but it was edited.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did they let the slurs go through on afternoon TV?
I think so. I'm not sure, because I must have heard it from somewhere.
Yeah. I remember some of the clips from this movie. I believe Opie and Anthony back in the 90s, they used some of the clips, audio clips from this movie on their radio show. So certain lines, I was like, oh, okay, yeah.
They cut out the curses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's about it. Because they saw that. I think they also showed the Kentucky Fried Movie network TV a couple. Well, I mean, they're kind of the same. Not, they're similar.
Yeah.
They were the Kentucky Fried Movie was basically a sketch movie, and this one has... It's almost like a sketch movie, but not as...
Yeah. It's like this anthology movie that traces through the history. And,
everything I knew about Judaism and Jewish people is from Mel Brooks movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're watching a Mel Brooks movie, you're going to get some Jewish jokes. And I think I was telling Darren off air that... I never got around to seeing this one as a kid. I remember seeing the trailers for it, and I love the gag of Moses coming down from the mountain with the 15 crash, 10 commandments. Mm. I thought that was hilarious. But we never saw this movie when I was a kid, I would have been about 9 when it came out. It actually came out in June 12th, 1981. So I would have been 8, nearly 9.
Oh,
so.
I was much younger.
Yeah, I was like 4.
Well, I am older than you both. So
all right. Yeah.
But funny. I'm trying to think if it, because it wouldn't have been on that. It wouldn't have been on TV for like a few more years. So I was probably maybe. They probably would have been showing it to like probably 84 or maybe even the mid to late 80s. So I probably was maybe 10.
Yeah.
Way too young to be watching it, though.
Yeah. I remember at one point my family, we went to see, it must have been a re-release of Blazing Saddles. So this probably would have been sometime in like the late 70s, early 80s. And we made it as far as the campfire scene. And then my folks were like, yeah, we're not staying for the rest of this. We're taking the kids out. And I think back on this and I'm just like, okay, so all the N-bombs weren't the deal breaker.
But farting. That's where we draw the line.
Yeah. It's like bread and community. I'm like, I can tolerate racism, but...
Tolerate racism? Yeah, it's that.
I can forgive racism. I should quote it correctly.
I've heard stories like this from so many of my friends' parents. Uh-huh. I mean, not from them, but from so many of my friends about their parents. And I'm like, we wonder how we are, why we are where we are. Mm.
To be fair, I don't think that was maybe so much the deal breaker as the straw that broke the camel's back. They probably like it was. I'm sure that was building. Before that moment in the movie. But like when I watch the movie now, I'm just like, okay, all right. Yeah, so this was actually my first time through with this. I'd never gotten around to seeing this before. Darren, had you seen it before or no?
I had seen parts of it. I think I did watch the whole thing through, but I don't remember it. Yeah, for some reason this movie... Like, it's not one of the first movies you think about, really, when you think about Mel Brooks. Like, it's not – it's a good movie, but I don't think it's up there with, like, you know, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, or, like, maybe even Spaceballs. Like, I feel like those movies, as soon as you hear Mel Brooks, you think of them. But, I mean, this movie, it still has, like, a legacy, and it's still beloved. I mean, to the point that Hulu came out with the History of the World Part 2 series not too long ago. So, like, you know, this does, and it does have some long lasting legs, like you said, the Ten Commandments bit, the It's Good to Be the King line, the Spanish Inquisition. Holy Lord.
I actually knew the whole song.
Can you really?
Yeah, it was like all the things I need to know, like, not there. But the Inquisition song is all still in my head.
It's a great song. It's catchy as hell. A
really good song.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you watch that and you see. You can see where maybe like a young Trey Parker and Matt Stone got their sensibilities from.
They have to be Mel Brooks fans.
Yeah, like you can see the bones of, you know, Book of Mormon and the stuff that was in the South Park movie in the Spanish Inquisition for sure.
I think they're also like, I feel like Monty Python had to be an influence on this movie because he's doing this extended bit in the Roman Empire that's just a couple of years after Life of Brian came out. Mm. And he's also doing the Spanish Inquisition, which is one of the most famous Python bits. So I don't have any evidence or quotes to back this up, but I feel like Mel Brooks had to be influenced by Python in this. And I was reading that he apparently wanted to cast John Cleese in Harvey Korman's part towards the end. In the French Revolution segment, the Count de Monet, but like Cleese couldn't do it because of scheduling conflicts or something.
I think he's in the movie.
Is he? Where?
I think he's one of the prisoners in the Inquisition scene. Because one of them had right before Jackie Mason.
Okay.
Oh no, that's. Hold on. There's
other British comedians in there. Like Spike Milligan shows up towards the end. He plays Mansour Ramaud.
Right, but Rimbaud. The torture victim with Jackie Mason. That's Ronnie Graham. That's with
him. Okay.
Who's another actor? You know, comedian. There's a lot of like kind of, I don't know, old-timey is the right word, but there are a lot of comedians that you can tell, like, Mel Brooks either revered or worked with. I mean, we see, like, Sid Caesar in the beginning.
It's a very Catskills comedian.
Yes. Henny Youngman's in it for a bit.
I mean, it's just super Jewish.
It is.
Like, when you have Jackie Mason, you know.
And Jackie Mason is credited as Jew number one, I think. Which I noticed in the closing credits. I was like, okay, well, that's a good credit to have, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Shecky Green's in this thing.
You got Jackie Mason. Like, you couldn't get more Jew. You got B. Arthur.
The great, late, great B. Arthur. You got Sammy and Shore.
Harvey Korman's Jewish, too.
Yeah. I mean, okay, I'm getting a little creepy feeling when we're just listing Jewish people.
Yeah, I'm going to slowly back away from this conversation.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys can. So, about the Jews. No, the Mel Brooks movies are really why I've always had such an affinity for, like, that community. Because, like, I just felt like I grew up, and I say this all the time, I grew up on old Jewish comedians, and I really did. I grew up on, like, all these guys from Mel Brooks movies, and then, like, you know, they still did stand-up. They used to still show their stand-up in the 80s and 90s on Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Got a lot of my sense of humor from. History of the World was definitely influential to who I am as a person. And then, like, you know, there's Yiddish in every movie. Like, people are like, where did you learn Yiddish from? I'm like, there's Yiddish in every movie. Like,
I think the Yiddish I picked up as a kid was probably from Mad Magazine. And I didn't realize it was Yiddish. It was just, like, funny sounding nonsensical words to me.
Yeah, putz. They would use
putz or schmuck or.
And Golden Girls too. Sophia, the Italian woman, used to speak Yiddish all the time. She would always call Stan a yutz and a putz and a schmuck. That's not Italian.
Yeah, why did you do that? Like, was Stan?
Because Estelle Getty was Jewish. B. Arthur was Jewish. Probably a lot of the writers too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, and there's a long history of Jews playing Italians and Italians playing Jews. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I feel just from watching so many of his movies, I feel like I picked up a lot of, you know, just osmosized a lot of Jewish culture through that. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for it because, you know, you got to learn about people different from yourself.
Mm. This is true. This is true.
And how good of you.
So,
well, and you know, Mel Brooks' whole thing is that, like, you have to belittle fascists. Because they want to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
And so he just really understood, like, understands that, like, humor is the best way to take people down a peg. And it's the best way to get ideas across and stuff.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And, yeah, I think he said, like, his mission in life was to make people laugh at Hitler. And I would say mission accomplished, Mel Brooks.
I respect that. Yeah, because I guess we're just kind of jumping all over the place, but that's how
the movie jumps all over the place, too.
It does, too. Because, I mean, with, like, the Spanish Inquisition, that might have been my favorite part. I really enjoyed it. But I could see how, like, if this came out today, people would be like, oh, he's making light of it, or he's making fun of such a horrible atrocity type of thing. But yeah, like, I mean, you have to kind of see it through Mel Brooks' eyes, like, the way you said it, Minus, where, like, he's taking, like, he's making fun of them in a way, but not at the same time belittling the, you know, the horribleness of it in a way. It's a fine line he's walking there.
Yeah, and I read he actually had a joke that he cut out of the movie, I think, after tests. Screenings didn't go so well. He had a joke about Three Mile Island, which was only, like, a couple of years in the past. But, like, test audiences were like, no, thank you.
And triggered much?
Yeah. So, but, I mean, something like the Inquisition or the French Revolution, that's so far in the past, and obviously there are no people from that time still around, so you can make jokes about that. But, you know, something from just a few years in the past, that's probably considered bad taste.
So. Yeah, fair enough. So let's talk about this movie. Let's break it down beat by beat. First of all, I like the fact that the whole thing is narrated by Orson Welles. That's a nice
cool. Yeah.
It's pretty cool. And the movie starts off with the dawn of man, these ape-like creatures standing up, becoming man. And, like, the first thing they do is, like, kind of grunt and hump and, like, make beating off motions.
They are living up to the name Homo erectus, yes.
Yes. And, of course, right underneath it, it says our forefathers.
Yeah.
Was that a reference? Because they played a was that a reference to another movie?
Oh yeah, I mean he's totally riffing on 2001 there.
Okay, it is 2000 because I never saw 2000, but didn't 2001 open with like monkeys and that
2001
that kind music.
Of, yeah, it famously opens up with the dawn of man, and we see like a bunch of Neanderthal men. And they're doing things, and they're like the monolith appears, and then they learn how to use tools, and then somebody, one of the ape men, like clubs a guy to death with a bone, and so it's like sort of the original sin, and then he tosses a bone up into the air, and there's a smash cut to a satellite in the air that is kind of shaped like a bone.
So, oh yeah, yeah. That is a reference.
Yeah. So in 2001, it's basically like man. Has not really, he's become more advanced, but he hasn't really learned anything in all these hundreds of thousands of years. Yep. So,
4th of July.
4th of July. Yay. America.
America. So, and then it goes from that into the Stone Age, where we see, Sid Caesar as one of the cavemen.
Yeah. Surprisingly in shape, Sid Caesar.
Sid Caesar is buffer than I would have guessed. Yes.
Dude is yoked. I will say that, yeah.
I'm like, all right, Sid Caesar, go ahead.
I don't know what, like, Sid Caesar was doing for his health regimen, but I think it was working, you know? I would have guessed, you know, you'd be like, what would Sid Caesar look like in a caveman tunic and loincloth? Yeah. I would have guessed probably skinny. No, he's surprisingly jacked.
Well, you're taking creatine shakes and, you know, not skipping leg day. My man's out here.
He's the first artist. He's making cave paintings, and then they say then shortly after the first artist, we had the first art critic, and then you know one guy just pees on the cave painting, which is a good gag.
I did like the gag of where he's trying to start fire with two rocks, and he gets frustrated, and then the caveman that comes by with the torch, and so then Caesar takes that torch and tries to light the rock with it. And throw it on a pile of fire, but it doesn't work. So he just gives him the torch back. He's like, all right, well.
There's a lot of dumb jokes in this movie. And I've gotten older, I've grown to appreciate dumb jokes more. Because I think when you're young, you think like everything has to be really wordy. And then you realize that like sometimes you can just fill in the spaces with a dumb joke.
Yeah. And
that's fine.
Yeah.
There is something to be said for a dumb joke, or especially a smart dumb joke, because it's just very visceral. It just hits you on that primal level.
Modern Family was amazing at that. They would layer dumb jokes to a smart joke, and like that. And you know, this movie will too. It's like it'll be like sight gags or dumb jokes, and then it'll be like, oh, that's the point.
Yeah,
very much so. Like the part when the caveman drops a rock on another caveman's foot and he screams, and that's how they create music.
Yeah.
And they figure, oh, we could just drop rocks on people's feet, and then they end up singing like the Hallelujah chorus. Yeah.
It's like, I like the gag where they said like, oh, and then there was the first marriage between a man and a woman, and they just show a man clubbing a woman over the head.
Yes.
Which, you know, so wrong, but...
And then right after that, the first gay marriage.
Yeah, the first gay marriage, and a dude clubbing another dude over there.
That was a thing I was like, oh, wow, look, that joke happened and the world didn't end.
Yeah. It's kind of a progressive joke.
Things went on.
It's, like, I mean, it's nice that collapsed. It is a gay joke where it's not just, oh, ha-ha, they're gay.
Yeah.
So... Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just about man's savagery in general. So,
yeah, there you go. Equality.
Equality. Yeah.
No one was blackballed. Nobody lost their mind. Yeah. It turns out that it's just okay.
Wow. So, let's see. We got like the quick gag with the Old Testament, which is really just Mel Brooks as Moses saying, like, these are the 15 crashed commandments.
Yes, and uncredited voiceover of God is Carl Reiner,
the late great Carl Reiner. Oh, nice. I didn't know that. That's cool.
According to Wikipedia, yeah, that was Carl.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. And then I read that they came up with that gag on the spot. Like, Mel Brooks was just looking at the cave sets they built for the Dawn of Man sequence, and he's like, oh, what else can we do here? And he came up with the Ten Commandments gag.
Oh, nice.
So that was really just kind of when I saw that. Shooting. What was that, John?
I was so young when I saw that. I'm pretty sure I still think there's 15 commandments. Like, that was my, because I didn't go to church or anything. Like, a lot of what I know about religion is from this movie.
Apparently, they gags on the third tablet. On the Ten Commandments are the two word Hebrew versions of the commandments: don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, etc. The five more don'ts on the third tablet that Moses accidentally drops are: don't impregnate, don't laugh, don't buy, and the last one: don't break. So that's a little bonus gag for the Hebrew speakers in the audience. So,
oh, L'chaim.
Yeah.
See, I know Jewish stuff too.
Yeah.
Okay. And then next up we have one of the longer pieces in this movie, The Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, this is like one of the longer stories.
Yeah, it's like 49 minutes of the movie. I think the Roman sequence does go on a little longer than it needs to, personally.
A little bit.
But I think part of that is just how movies were paced differently in 1981,
So we go to Rome, we see people selling things on the street. Apparently one of the persons selling columns, according to Wikipedia, mm-hmm. that was Barry Levinson.
Barry Levinson worked with Mel Brooks in his early days, and he wrote for him. I know he pops up in High Anxiety as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. He's the guy who's like beating Mel Brooks with a newspaper in the shower.
Oh, sure. So, gotta go back and look at that.
That's a young Barry Levinson.
Yes.
And one of the people in the Marketplace cameo is a cameo from Albert Whitlock, who painted all the matte paintings in this movie. And he is like one of the all-time great matte painters in Hollywood history.
Oh, nice. And I know the soothsayer was Charlie Callis, mm-hmm. who's an old-timey comic that worked with Mel Brooks and Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm saying old-timey.
I
he was current at the time.
It's old-timey to me.
Yeah, but they were, honestly, they were probably like somewhere in their 50s.
But I don't want to think about that.
But I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But
that's what I was thinking. I'm like, Mel Brooks had access to a lot of talent. He had access to a lot of people. And I was thinking, like, I don't even know if there's that many people of that ability available to do a movie like this. When people say you can't do a movie like this anymore, I don't think so much of like the political climate or things like that. I think of like, are there people willing to do these parts?
Yeah.
Who are good at it?
Yeah.
There's one guy, I can't remember one of the, oh, it's in the, it's one of the Senate, a lot of the Senate guys just sounded like some guys.
Mm-hmm.
They just sounded like the one guy who's like, what do you say? Oh God, what was it? When he says, somebody's sick. And he's like, I didn't know she was sick. That's just some guy. Uh-huh. Like, he doesn't look like a professional actor. He just, and there's a lot of people in the movie who just seem like some guy. And I don't know if you say like if they made it today, that would have been a beautiful person.
Yeah,
oh, I see.
Like, there's a lot of people in this movie who just look like people. They don't look like actors, and that.
Although there is a segment where they very pointedly cast a bunch of beautiful people.
Oh yes,
well, the Vestal Virgins. They apparently are all Playboy playmates.
Well, I mean, that's why you got to. That's why you got to put the man in there.
So Hugh Hefner.
Yes, we do get a Hugh Hefner cameo in there. Like after we see a banner up to saying advertising the whether the orgy and buffet,
the Temple of Eros annual orgy and buffet, first served, first come.
Jesus, so. I saw that. I was like, "What is this movie rated?" Oh my god,
very vague. Very Vegas.
I did. I just like the bit where we see we very briefly see Bea Arthur at the unemployment office, and she's like, "Oh, you're a gladiator. Have you killed anyone this week?" No. Well, you know, you're on your last week of unemployment. So if you don't kill someone this week, you're going to lose your benefits.
That was very triggering to me because I didn't know that unemployment was always that way.
Yeah.
Like when I've had to apply for it, I didn't know it at the time. But like when I get older, I'm like, oh, wow, this is just like Bea Arthur.
Yeah.
And then we also see Mel Brooks, who's filing for unemployment. He's a stand-up philosopher. And of course, Bea Arthur says, oh, you mean a bullshit artist? And then she asks him, did you bullshit last week? Did you try to bullshit last week?
It was any of that lies.
Mm-hmm.
No.
No lies. Absolutely. True. It's as true then as it is today.
I mean, it's heartening that they consider stand-up comedy an occupation. So
that's actually better benefits than we have.
Yeah.
Bullshit last week.
And Mel Brooks' character, Comicus, he has an agent named Swiftus Lazarus, which is, of course, a play on the great or the famous Hollywood agent, Swifty Lazar. So.
Nice. That I did not know.
Yeah. That joke is maybe a little lost to time because I don't know if people really know who Swifty Lazar was anymore. I know the name, and that's about it, I think.
Did
Mel Brooks ever do stand-up?
He probably did, right?
Say the 2000-year-old man stuff that he did with Carl Reiner, that probably qualifies as stand-up.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, because they perform that in clubs, I believe, so.
Yeah.
It's a stand-up in my book.
For sure. I would say that. And then after that, we see Swiftus gets him a gig at Caesar's Palace. Right. Then it cuts to this slave auction,
right?
Where we see, like, at the end of the slave auction, the slaves that didn't get bought up, get sent to the Colosseum for lion bait, and one of the slaves does not want to go. It's played by the late great Gregory Hines.
Gregory Hines, film debut for Gregory Hines, by the way.
It's a good part.
Yeah.
It's a good part. He had good lines. He got to dance a little. It was a good part.
Gregory Hines, I think, was one of my favorite parts of the movie. I think he nailed everything they gave him to do. And apparently this part was written for Richard Pryor. And, you know, as Richard Pryor, very famously, was supposed to be in Blazing Saddles, co-wrote Blazing Saddles. But they like kind of shied away from him because he was considered controversial. So they brought in... why am I blanking on
that? Cleavon Little.
Cleavon Little, thank you.
I feel like it was a good decision in both. Richard Pryor has to be in a Richard Pryor movie.
Yeah.
I don't feel like Richard Pryor can be in someone else's movie.
Oh, you mean like Superman 3?
Yeah.
Oof. I know people don't like that.
Just realize that, this would have been another movie with Richard Pryor and Pamela Stevenson beyond Superman 3. That's wild. But Richard Pryor was all set to be in this movie, and then 2 days before he was supposed to start shooting was the infamous cocaine
flame
incident. Yeah.
Yeah.
So obviously that wasn't going to happen. So Madeline Kahn recommended Gregory Hines, and Gregory Hines stepped in, and he's very funny.
I think it works better,
Just to talk about casting, I mean, because Madeline Kahn should have been in every movie. I don't know how that would have worked.
Yeah, logistically, that would have been tough.
But Madeline Kahn should have been in every movie. She's gorgeous. She's so good looking, and she's so funny in equal parts. And it's that whole Carol Burnett. Actually, it's kind of shocking Carol Burnett was never in any of his movies, because so many people from the Carol Burnett circle are in Mel Brooks things. True. That's part of him having access to so many funny people. But that's great that, because,
Madeline Kahn's amazing. I don't think I've ever seen a movie
never enough.
She was in that I didn't love her in. Even if I didn't like the movie, I always loved her in the movie. I mean, she's great in Blazing Saddles. She's great in Young Frankenstein. She's great in Clue. She's great in Paper Moon, which is a Peter Bogdanovich film from the 70s, and she's really good in that.
I think I've seen that one.
Yeah, that's worth seeing. I just saw it for the first time a couple of years ago, and it's really great. Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. So we'll get together sometime. I'll show you Paper Moon, Darren.
All right. Oh, date night. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we see...
And John, you're welcome to, of course.
We see Gregory Hines trying to, you know, not be taken to the lions. Mm-hmm. He knows that the lions are only Christians. He claims to be Jewish. Yeah. He sings Hava Nagila. He's like, oh, call the rabbi, call the temple, call Samus Davis Jr.
It's so funny because, like, right before they did that gag, I was like, oh, maybe they should have had Sammy Davis Jr. play this part. It would have been really funny if he was, like, denying that he was Jewish, but... Yeah, that's...
You actually needed an athletic person for that.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. There's a lot of running and fighting. That's true. And I don't think Sammy Davis Jr. or Richard Pryor would have been.
Yeah.
You had a much, I think, younger. Yeah, he's probably younger than both of them. And, like, he's a dancer.
Yeah.
He's like, a very, very, very good dancer. So, like, you know, the athletic parts were easy for him.
I wonder if they tailored it for Gregory Hines at all.
They probably changed it.
Oh, you know, let's have him do a little more dancing, because...
Right. He's from Ethiopia, 125th Street.
I mean, I love the gag where he's like, oh, I'm Jewish, and then they just, like, pull open his loincloth and look down at his crotch, and they're like, oh, you're Jewish, huh? And he just goes, he missed! That's such a great circumstance. I mean, that is
so funny.
It's like, oh, I have an appointment on Thursday. I'll get it done then.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's that. And then there's also another scene where somebody's horses collapse. And, like, the owner whips him. And then this beautiful woman tells him to not whip him. And then Comicus steps in and punches out the owner. Mm-hmm. And he sees that the horse has a rock in his hoof. So he gets up and the horse is okay. And then Swiftus recognizes that the horse is this famous racehorse named Miracle. And, like, this felt kind of shoehorned in a little bit, but then I saw, like, oh, okay, this comes back in later, this whole part with the horse.
Shoehorned in?
Oh, I didn't even mean to do that.
Oh, boy.
I did not even mean, look at me, I'm making hilarious jokes.
So,
I didn't mean to.
So Mel Brooks' character Comicus, he meets Miriam, a Vestal Virgin, who is played by Mary Margaret Hume. This is, like, I think her film debut, because she gets an introducing credit. And she went on to, like, work quite a bit. I know she, like, later ended up being Dawson's mom on Dawson's Creek.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So she looked vaguely familiar to me because of that. And, yeah.
Okay, nice. So then after that, the owner of the horse gets up to punch out Comicus again, but that's when Josephus knocks him out. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, when Comicus and Swiftus were looking at Josephus the slave, Gregory Hines, they thought he was really talented and they liked him. So then that's when we get the great Madeline Kahn entering as Empress Nympho.
Yes.
Who Miriam begs to help Comicus and Josephus,
you spare his life?
Because Josephus punched out a Roman citizen, which a slave is not supposed to do.
They frown on that.
One of the things I was laughing about a lot was the sound effects, because they're very, like, cartoon. Maybe not cartoony, but maybe it's just that they don't use it. Like, when they get punched, it's like... Psh! And it's the same with Blazing Saddles. Like, it's a specific sound for the sound effects of people getting punching, and they hit the ground and it's really loud. Like, everything that has a sound effect is really loud. It is was very funny to me.
Yeah, it kind of pushes it more into like a cartoony realm. Yeah, when the sound effects are that over the top.
Yeah, this movie gets very cartoonish with his humor in a lot of places. So then Miriam asks the Empress to save his to spare his life. She says, "Oh wait, which guy are you talking about? The white guy or the colored guy?" And the Empress asks her assistant Bob, like, does she have any openings that the slave might fit? And the audience goes, ooh.
Yeah, there's a studio audience for the whole scene. It's great.
And it says, like, we could use another wine steward. And then Joseph says, well, I got a great corkscrew. Ooh. Like, ooh, it's a hip crowd. All right.
And then we go to the palace, Caesar's Palace, and they actually have a shot of the real Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas.
Nice.
And they I like that gag. That was a cute gag.
Yeah, they're pulling into it like that. They're going through it. Like I didn't know if it was Atlantic City or not back then, but like
apparently it was Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. So
yeah, a lot of it had a Vegas. I think the whole thing with the buffet and everything just from the start they had a feeling that Rome would be like Vegas, and because every comedian wants to play Caesars.
Yeah. Early on, like Swift was.
So they just made it literal.
Swift Lazarus says, "Like, oh hey, I got you a gig at Caesar's Palace," and Comicus is very excited about that. And so we go to Caesar's Palace, and we got Dom DeLuise as Caesar.
The late great.
A
lot of late greats in this movie.
Yes. The movie is 45 years old. So, yeah, a lot of the people who are in this movie are no longer with us. But, you know, Mel Brooks still is. So.
Still kicking.
Mel Brooks. Still kicking it at 100. Kind of weird for me seeing Dom DeLuise without a beard. I'm always expecting Dom DeLuise to have a beard. Maybe because of the Cannonball Run movies. I don't know.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I get that. But yeah, like he plays this role pretty well. He's just constantly chewing up the scenery and just going over the top as this heavy set, gluttonous leader.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
Throwing slurs around.
Yeah.
I was not expecting the F slurs. That kind of surprised me.
So many times.
No, mostly backed into the scene, yeah.
I already told you, like, that. Okay. Like, it's so far back in my head, it's just not coming out.
Yeah.
Like, I can't say. But I was like, all right, what's next?
So Comicus performs for Caesar. He performs his act, and then Caesar's offended by, like, the fat jokes and the emperor jokes, and then he's... And then Gregory Hines spills wine on Caesar. So Caesar is offended, and he wants them both to fight each other to death over dessert.
Yes.
But there's another line, I think we passed it, that has been in my head forever. And it becomes more and more the Senate when a guy's talking about, building housing for the poor and everything. And he was like, well, what about the poor? And everybody says, fuck the poor.
That part comes later. That was a... Oh, that got a big laugh out of me.
Yeah.
That my whole life, every year of my life, I've realized how that is just truer and truer and truer. Like, that is American government. Yeah. American government has been fuck the poor at least since the 80s, but in all of history.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that line has aged the best out of any line in this movie, I would say.
Whenever
it is still 100% true. Another line that came, I think, just a little after this is when Mel Brooks and Gregory Hines are trying to escape from Caesar's Palace. And Gregory Hines says to Mel Brooks, "You're the first white person I even considered liking." That is a great line that has such a great bite to it.
I immediately thought of you, John.
Oh, well, thank you.
Don't take me too much. He only says considered.
Yeah, no, I get it. That's what makes it such a funny line. It's like, yeah, no, I haven't gotten to the point of liking you, but I considered it. I considered the idea of possibly liking you. I love that.
I mean, that is true. Sometimes I wonder, like, all right, who wrote that? I'm like,
honestly, John, when they when they had that line, I thought of you. Because it seemed like something you would say.
It's just what happens when you get older. Like, I didn't realize how true what Chris Rock said. Because I was, when I first heard, I forgot when that came out, but when he's like, there's nobody more racist than an old black man, I was like, oh, pshaw. Mm-hmm. And I thought of my grandfather. I was like, oh, well, that's true for him, but I'd never be that way. And you know, lo and behold,
you can't
just be alive as a black man and just not. But it's not, it's from things that happen to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's reasons.
Yeah. It's not like just a, like, oh, no. It's
not unjustified.
No, it's just that you just acquire things that happen to you that make you that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I thought you were going to talk about the Chris Rock line where he says, like, there's not a white person in the world who would switch places with me and I'm rich.
Also, I mean, same, you know, true. Yeah. But, yeah, there's so many... Like, again, I forgot. Who is Mark? Was Mark Anthony the leader of the army? I can't.
Oh, it's like that Marcus. Hold on. I wrote it down. That's the Shecky Green character. Marcus Vindictus.
Oh, that was Marcus Vindictus. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, he was good, too. Mm-hmm. He was very good. Is he actually pretty fairly intimidating?
Mm-hmm. Fairly. Yeah. I see that. Yeah, so then we see the part where Comicus and Josephus escape. They're running throughout the palace. The guards are looking for them. Then we cut to a part where the Empress is choosing escorts for her midnight orgy.
Sure, so she's
as you do. So she's choosing from all these pantsless guards.
We see a lot of centurion butts. Yeah,
a lot of butts. And then we also see that the guards come into her quarters. And we see Josephus is posing as one of the castrated eunuchs, mm-hmm. trying to hide from the guards. So the guards seem to be on him. So they test them all out by having a woman do this erotic dance in front of them. And, you know, nothing should arise.
And they're all holding these big fronds in front of them, like you'd have with a fan dancer or something like that. And then, you know, and as soon as they do that, you know that we're going to have a...
You can see where... Yeah, you can see where it's going.
I'm not sure if that scene jump-started me into puberty, but I it set me on a path.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
If you see
that at the right impressionable age, yes.
Like, I wasn't old enough. I was definitely prepubescent. So that gives me a timestamp. Because I wasn't like... But I was like, huh. I'm going to file this for later. I don't know why... Feels
it's
like
interesting to think back and like think about the movies you saw as a kid, and then sometimes you can think on like, oh, that was a thing I saw at an impressionable age that set me on a path.
This better not awaken anything immediately.
I know. I mean, a lot of people.
Second community quote of the pod.
We're doing it.
Yeah,
we might just do a community podcast one of these days, ladies and gentlemen.
We should. I'd be 100% down for that.
I have a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
Oof. It's a lot there. So, of course, the lady does the dance. And, of course, what happens as soon as she gets in front of Josephus, the fan or the feathers go up.
In my head, I remember there being a slide whistle when the feather went up, but there wasn't.
Hmm.
Missed opportunity.
Yeah. No, I remember there being a whoop, but there, and my brain just edited in there.
So Mel Brooks and Gregory Hines, they're trying to get out of the palace. They like disguise themselves in robes. Miriam, who's the Vestal Virgin, who's kind of befriended them, she's like trying to help them get away. And they get away in a chariot pulled by Miracle, the white horse from before.
Right. And then we also get a cameo from Henny Youngman where the guards are looking for them and they stop Henny Youngman and it's like, oh, we're looking for a pack of Trojans walking around. And of course, Henny Youngman says, of course, gee, I just ran out.
Yeah.
Condoms, guys. Trojans. Condoms, Rose. Condoms. Yeah. Condoms.
I didn't know Trojans had been around that long. Like the condom brand?
I think they've pretty much always been the preeminent brand of condoms, right? I mean, I certainly wasn't aware of Trojans in 1981, but...
Yeah.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's appropriate. We were children.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, true. It would be disturbing if we were familiar with Trojans in 1981, if any of us were.
Yeah, yeah.
Just going up in
something has gone hideously wrong.
Just going up to some schoolmates in the playground, like, hey, you guys wrapping it up?
I mean, I had brought cigarettes at that point, but now.
Oh,
your parents never sent you to the store for cigarettes?
No. My parents don't smoke, so.
Yeah. My parents weren't smokers either.
Growing up, I heard other people, like, yeah, they would just send us to the store with a note. we'd pick up, like, milk and soda and cigarettes and bring them back home.
As you do.
It's a different time.
It's the 80s. Yeah, the 80s were...
Amazing. Wild time, man.
So we get a chariot race as our heroes are getting away in a chariot pulled by miracle. And then Gregory Hines, he makes them stop, and they're at a field of wacky weedus, as they call it. So Gregory Hines makes a gigantic joint, like the size of...
It's like a Cypress Hill blunt.
Yeah, there you go.
like that type of thing.
So he lights it, and then they're, you know, the smoke is blowing behind them, and that's getting all the soldiers chasing them high.
I also didn't know what that was.
Yeah, you probably didn't get that joke until you were
older. I thought it was just like a thing, like, oh yeah, there's some weeds that if you burn them, it makes you be weird. I had no idea that it was a drug that people.
Yeah.
Like, I know about cigarettes, but I don't know about this thing.
Funny cigarettes.
Jazz cigarettes.
Yeah.
Good. But yeah, so they make it to the ship port because they find out that Miriam's telling them that the ship leaving for Judea.
Yes.
So they're able to get to Judea to escape. We see that the guards are still high off the weed, and at one point they do like the Lindy Hop. We get like a nice little dance number from them.
Yeah, it's very random. Yes,
very random.
Yeah, which was old at that time.
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe it was just a dance that everybody knew how to do. I don't know. I'm wondering why he picked the Lindy Hop.
Mel Brooks, like, you guys all know how to do the Lindy Hop, right?
Right. Yeah.
It would have been weird if they did disco. I feel like it was the right choice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a disco gag wouldn't have aged very well.
Yeah, I mean there kind of was one, because, like, there was one scene where they, like, in the walking the streets of Rome, there's, like, one black guy with a boombox playing with Funky Town playing on it.
So
That was great.
I don't know if that was so much a disco joke as a slightly racist joke, maybe.
Oh, but... yeah. You know, I think you might be right. Hey, I think I'm offended.
Rome's a big city. You get people with boomboxes in big cities.
That's it. So they all get on to the ship to Judea, and then we learn after they get there, they answer a help wanted ad for a cashier, a waiter, and a dishwasher. And then we see Mel Brooks as Comicus, and he's the party he's waiting on is the Last Supper. Right. And Jesus is in the midst of telling him, like, one of you will betray me three times before the
Judas.
Yeah. and so Mel Brooks is in the background of this. He's like, excuse me, are all 12 of you together, or is it going to be separate checks? I like that gag. That was a really funny gag.
Nice. And we have Jesus played by the late, great John Hurt as well.
Oh, geez. That was John Hurt?
That's what it says here.
I read that John Hurt was in the movie. And, of course, like, he pops up in Spaceballs, too. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
I didn't recognize him with the beard. Oh, that's awesome.
Wow, the beard really throws... John DeLuise, John Hurt, like, as soon as somebody had the beard, you can't... It really throws you off.
Yeah, it's triggering some face blindness, I guess.
If you change somebody's hair at all, I don't know who they are.
Yeah.
At all.
Also, because it's like, I think of John Hurt as an older guy, and this is like John Hurt of 45 years ago, so I'm not expecting John Hurt to be like, in his 30s or whatever, so.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, and then we see Da Vinci coming in to paint the portrait, and of course he tells everybody, look, if you all want to be in this portrait, you got to be on the one side of the table. Right. And then he paints a portrait, and we see Comicus in the back holding up a plate above Jesus' head.
Yeah. That's cute.
Yeah, yeah, I think, but I like the segment quite a bit. But yeah, I do agree with you, Trumbull, where it does go on a little too long. Like, I feel like they could have tightened this up a little bit more. But a lot of good gags in this, I thought.
No, I don't think so. I think the ending of Blazing Saddles might have went on a little too long. But I don't feel it for like this. Now, I mean, but like I said, this was a formative thing for me, so
mm-hmm. Is this your favorite Mel Brooks film?
I can never decide between this and Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
I really can never decide. I go back and forth. Depends on the day, depends on the minute.
Yeah.
No, Blazing Saddles.
I think I'm a Young Frankenstein guy first and foremost.
Ooh.
Because I love the parodies of the Universal horror films in that. But Blazing Saddles is maybe just a notch below that. But it's been ages since I've seen either version of the producers, and I got to revisit those.
I saw History of the World first. Uh-huh. So, and like, you know, like I already mentioned, it's part of my personality. Yeah. I was a little more formed when I saw Blazing Saddles, but it holds that same place in my head. And you know, people are like, "Oh, the movies you like when you were like," no, I enjoyed it as much today as I did then. Like, there's no nostalgia.
Yeah.
No, I freaking love this.
I love it when you can move with the movie through the years and you still like it as an adult. And you might like it for different reasons than you liked it as a kid, but I love it when you can like see new things in a movie, and it's not because the movie's changing, it's because you're changing as a person. So
yeah.
No, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, for me, like, I know I grew up, I mean, my first Mel Brooks introduction was like stuff like Spaceballs and Robin Hood Men in Tights. So like I have like connection to those, but like after I went back and I watched things like Blazing Saddles and this movie and like Young Frankenstein.
You need to watch Channel 11.
What's up? Yeah, yeah, on Channel 11. But yeah, like I went back and watched these movies. I was like, oh, I think these movies might be better than the films like I got introduced to Mel Brooks through, like, you know, Men in Tights and Spaceball. I still think it's pretty solid, though. I still get a kick.
I enjoy Spaceballs. I remember at the time thinking, like, oh, I wish this was more like a general science fiction parody than just specifically Star Wars parody all the way through. But, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, so. Fair enough. So next up in the movie, 1489, let's get into the Spanish Inquisition.
I was not expecting this.
Nobody expects this. Okay. So 1489.
Got that out of your system?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Okay.
I feel great. So heretics are being burned by the Grand Inquisitor, people who is converting people to the true church. Mm-hmm. You know, either convert or forever burn in hell. And then we cut to a straight up musical number about them converting the Jews.
They don't teach a lot. Like, in my 40s, I've been wondering what I learned in school.
I don't remember being taught this at all.
So much of what I have been taught have learned since has just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Or is wildly misinterpreted. And then it was just so much that we just never got brought up.
No,
they didn't really teach us about the Inquisition. Yeah. Especially, like, so I saw this obviously before high school, but like, they never brought up Tuckamata in high school.
Yeah.
I was never like, oh, that guy from the movie. Like, it just. So this is, again, all I knew about the Spanish Inquisition was there was a lot of singing and dancing.
Yeah. No, a lot of stuff gets kind of left out off the, you know, out of the schools. Like, I still remember when, like, that HBO series Watchmen came out and they talked about the Tulsa Massacre, and everybody was like, oh, is this real? What is this? What?
Yeah.
This happened? And I was like, yeah, Tulsa Massacre, it happens.
But even this scene felt like, if you watch it, it feels not dated, but it doesn't feel like current.
That's true. I mean, like, historical epics were like a big thing in like the 50s in particular, I think, and like into the early 60s. And we don't really have those like we used to. I mean, I don't know. Once in a while you have like a movie like Gladiator that's a hit, but yeah, we don't really have like the sword and sandal epics or anything like that anymore.
Not really, like the Ben-Hurs and yeah, that's kind of a from a bygone era. They had like Troy that came out a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like some genres go in and out of style. Like, I mean, you know, yeah. Westerns never really came back in a big, big way. I mean, yeah. Every once in a while there's a Western that hits, but...
Yeah, and I mean, Christopher Nolan has The Odyssey coming out this summer, so maybe that's, he's trying to sort of get back to that. Okay. But I will say, as a musical number, I think this is pretty great, really. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you can really tell that Mel Brooks really enjoys a good musical. Like, the way it's structured, and, you know, with, like, the interstitials of Jackie Mason and Ronnie Graham and their little back and forth, which is something, like, you'd see in, like, a real... like musical, and even like little things like the guards being like, "Hey, Torquemada, what do you say? I just came back from order to fate." Little things like that.
He's always had a flair for musical numbers, and I think he sticks a musical number at some point in most every one of his films. Mm. I mean, in Young Frankenstein, you got the Putting on the Ritz number. I mean, that's not an original song, of course, but you know, Blazing Saddles. He's got music in there. Spaceballs, he's got music in there. And High Anxiety, I know there's, like, yes. He sings a song called High Anxiety in that movie. So, yeah, that's, and of course, he was able to segue that into the huge musical success that was The Producers on Broadway. Mm. And, you know, the original Producers movie has the Springtime for Hitler number, of course, famously. So, yeah, so Mel Brooks has always been good.
Movie. Yeah.
I just got a message from John saying that he unfortunately lost his power and he had an out anyway. So we're going to have to muddle through the rest of this movie on our own, Darren.
Oh, boy.
But thank you to our guest, John Minus. We're sorry you were only able to stay for halfway through the movie. But
yeah. So fare thee well, Mr. Minus. Fare thee well. Where am I at? Oh, yeah. So then we get into this part where they say there have been no conversions. The next is send in the nuns. And then they do this, mm-hmm. like, Esther Williams, like, aquatic ballet number.
Yeah. Yeah. That's...
I was like, wow.
We got some nun bathing beauties. I also like the gag in there when they're spinning the wheels with the prisoners on the rack. Mm. And it's, like, coming up like a roulette.
Like a slot machine, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, like a slot machine.
It's like, oh, this is where all the money went. There's some production footage.
Yeah, apparently the set for the castle set that they built for the Inquisition sequence was like, that was literally $1 million.
Jesus.
And I think it's also enhanced with some of the map paintings from Albert Whitlock, who is so good. I know the name Albert Whitlock. He actually painted some of the map paintings on the original Star Trek too.
Oh, nice.
And you know, most any of the historical epics that we've seen, there are probably Albert Whitlock paintings in there. Look up Albert Whitlock and just be amazed at all the shit this guy's done. It's unreal.
Done and done. But yeah, then we get this this aquatic ballet. We see the rabbis are slid into the water as the nuns hold them down. And it's like, wow. Because the material is... It is kind of caustic, but they... play it in a way where, like, I don't know how Mel Brooks was able to find a humor in this, but it is, maybe because he also plays it, like, so big and so over the top, like, especially as his character, the Torquemada, where he's, like, smiling and, like, kind of just mugging for the camera all the time, like, yeah, like, it's just, like, he plays it so big and over the top, it kind of downplays the seriousness of it, or it takes away something from it that doesn't mm-hmm. make it as troubling as it could have been.
Yeah. I mean, we are talking about a historical period where lots of people were tortured and killed and bad stuff going on, which is why I find it so wild that the Three Mile Island gag was considered over the line.
I think it's because, like you said, it happened so recently. Yeah. There was no time.
Yeah.
Like from it. Like the same way, like, after, you know, 9/11 happened, you couldn't really make jokes about it. But mm-hmm. like now you probably could in a way you couldn't back then.
Yeah. I mean, it has been, gosh, 25 years since 9/11. So I think, yeah. And then And I think eventually it will be something like maybe the way we look at the Hindenburg today, where it's like, oh, it's an awful thing that happened in history, but no one from the Hindenburg explosion is still around. So
yeah, or like even Pearl Harbor or something like that.
Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah.
But yeah, this part, I really enjoyed this part. I thought it was like,
this was like the highlight of the movie for you, right?
I think so. It's just because like the way the musical number it's done, and mm-hmm. the fact that they were able to take something so horrific and mine the comedy out of it. Like, it's really impressive. Like, if you asked me to do something about the Spanish Inquisition, I would have been like, no, that's I want none of that. I don't want no smoke, as the kids
say. I just wouldn't want to touch it just because, you know, the Python stuff casts such a long shadow for
that
me.
That too, yeah.
Like, I grew up on Python more than Mel Brooks, I would say.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I certainly saw Mel Brooks stuff along the way. I know I saw Spaceballs in my teen years, and I saw Men in Tights in theaters, and I can't remember when I came to Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles, but I love both of those. And it still blows my mind that he came out with both of those movies in one calendar year. Those both came out in 1974.
Jeez. Which is
making two classic comedies in the space of 1 year is
amazing.
Unreal to me.
Unreal. So we left where we left off. The French Revolution. So we're in Paris.
Uh-huh.
The streets are lousy with poor people selling apple cores.
Apple cores that the aristocracy has discarded. Yeah.
Yes. Wealthy apple cores from rich people. That's, mm-hmm. you know, big yeah. money. Dead rats. We see somebody stealing a dead rat from a cart.
Yeah.
We see beggars begging from other beggars. And
Mel Brooks, I think, was playing a salesman who was like, I have nothing. I'm selling nothing. And he's got like an empty cart that just has a sign that says nothing. And, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, just poverty ravaging the streets.
Mm-hmm.
We see Cloris Leachman
mm-hmm.
As Madame Defarge, who has an inn, who's secretly trying to get the grief-stricken together to start a revolution. Vive la revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Said. We're in 1789 now, I believe. So it's, yeah, right around the time of the French Revolution, where, you know, right. lots of people are going to get beheaded and right. stuff.
And they're talking about how they're so poor, they have no rights, no say, they don't even have a language, just a stupid accent.
Yeah, they're all like, we all sound like Maurice Chevalier.
It was a good
gag. I like that gag. Yeah, that was a good joke.
It's a gag. Like, hey, we're in Paris, but no one's speaking French. Just French accents.
Because they're too poor to have an actual French language.
Exactly. Then we're introduced to Count de Monet.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Harvey Korman, and mm-hmm. you know, like we said, a play off of Count the Money. Everybody calls him Count the Money in this movie, but he corrects him saying it's Count de Monet.
Yeah, and so it's a bit of a callback to the famous gag in Blazing Saddles where he played Hedley Lamarr, and everyone wanted to call him Hedy Lamarr, like the actress, and so he was correcting people throughout the movie. And I think at one point Mel Brooks was like, hey, don't worry, it's 18 such and so, you'll be able to sue her.
Nice little inside jokes like that.
Yeah, I mean, like Mel Brooks likes doing callbacks to his previous projects and in his projects. So
yeah, there's a callback to something that happens earlier in this movie at the end of this movie, but we'll
get to that. Yeah,
we'll get to that. So I did like the gag of when Count de Monet and his partner, Bernays,
mm-hmm.
They pull up to the king's quarter. And at the gate, there's all these, you know, poor people, beggars begging for money. And mm-hmm. the servants of the king just roll a red carpet over the beggars
mm-hmm.
to the chariot, the carriage that has the count. And the count just like they literally just walk all on and over the downtrodden poor people.
Yeah, good sight gag.
Good sight gag.
And so we've got Mel Brooks in, well, let's see, it's like his fourth or fifth role in the film. I don't remember which one was introduced first because he plays two characters in this segment. He's playing King Louis, the 14th, I believe, and he's also playing Jacques, who is literally they call him the piss boy, who's wandering around with a bucket, so that the aristocracy can relieve themselves into the bucket.
Yeah, I don't know much about history, but I was like, is this a thing? This can't have been a thing.
I don't think that was a thing. I hope it wasn't a thing.
I mean, he had to have gotten the idea from somewhere.
Right? I don't know. I haven't. I don't want to go down that Google rabbit hole. I feel like me starting a search with piss boy would not lead to good results.
Yeah. Yeah, don't do that at work. Don't Google that at work, folks.
No.
You'll get a call from HR. Yeah, so we see King Louis playing chess, but he's doing with actual people as the chess pieces. He has one of his chess pieces jump the queen, and a guy actually gets on top of the queen, and another person gets on top of the queen. And before you know it, he shouts out, "Gang bang, let's all jump the queen," which, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's 1981 is 1981ing really hard right now.
Yeah, but I mean, like the way it's done, it looks more cartoonish than actually like a how do I say this?
It's not as sexual assaulty as
you
might think.
Exactly, it's not like The Accused or nothing like that.
Oh, God.
It's more cartoonish than that. But even then, I was like, wow.
More cartoonish than The Accused. There's a poll quote for the poster.
Why wasn't that the tagline? That's what I said.
More cartoonish than The Accused. Darren Patterson, SNL nerd.
That's right. God. For those that don't know about The Accused, maybe you don't want to. I think I remember watching that movie, and I was like, Jesus.
I have read enough about The Accused that I'm like, I don't think I ever need to see The Accused.
It is some heavy shit. I'm ashamed for even making a joke about it. I'm ashamed. I'm terrible. But yeah, so while that's going on, the count, you know, even though he's not crazy about the king, he realizes he needs to protect the crown and the monarchy. And as he needs to relieve himself, he calls over the piss boy, Jacques, and he even notices how much Jacques looks like the king, which is something he kind of saves for later. And then this is where we get our SNL connection. Pamela Stevenson plays Mademoiselle Rimbaud, who approaches the king about his trying to get his father out of the Bastille. Her father out of the Bastille, saying that he was in there for saying something at a party that somebody overheard. And he said, "The poor ain't so bad."
Yeah, and so he's been in the Bastille for 10 years because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And the king, they've sort of already established that the king is this very lecherous sort.
Yes.
Yeah, so he goes up to one woman, and I think he just sort of like does a quick motorboat on her chest or something like that, and then he turns the camera and goes, "It's good to be the king."
He says this like three times throughout this movie. It's like
it's
a catchphrase.
It's become like a Mel Brooks catchphrase, and I know there's like a callback to it in the stage and movie versions of the producer's musical. That has become very associated with Mel Brooks. And so he puts it to Mademoiselle Rimbaud, Pamela Stevenson's character, and he says, "Well, you know, if I'm doing something for you, you got to do something for me."
Yeah.
And she's like, "Oh no, I couldn't do that. I was raised in a convent, and I don't indulge in pleasures of the flesh." And he oh so sweetly puts it, "You don't put out, he don't get out."
I hate that I laughed at that. It's the worst.
Yeah, and he boils the choice down to hump or death. And he's like, "You have 3 seconds to decide." So yeah, he's a real prince, this king.
He's a real piece of work.
Yeah. And she's agonized over it. And I'm having a little tough time like laughing at this. It's not quite as absurd as it probably seemed in 1981, but I can't help but look at it through 2026 eyes, and I'm just like, oh, this is creepy.
Yeah, like I feel like with this part, he needed to do something more to make it a little bit more cartoonish.
Yeah,
just more so it would, yeah, just so it wouldn't feel so like, oh, this feels really wrong. Like, you know, like it did with the Spanish Inquisition and like other parts
right.
of history that are a little like, oh, this ain't funny. I feel like it was, there were funny parts. Well, actually, maybe not that funny, but yeah, this part was a little tougher to get through.
Also. The other thought I had, I was like, why isn't the same actress playing Miriam in the Roman Empire sequence and Mademoiselle Rimbaud in this sequence? Because like they're both sort of, you know, one's a Vestal virgin, the other one's like, oh, I was raised in a convent. And I was like, that might have been an interesting callback because we have sort of parallels between the other characters. So I'm wondering why he decided to cast two different actresses in those parts.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm not sure why, you know, just for like, could have done like a little continuity thing and just had the same people play different.
Yeah, and it's not that like either Mary Margaret Hume or Pamela Stevenson did a bad job by any means. They were both great, I thought. But
yeah,
I was just thinking like, oh, you know, if I was doing it, I might have had the same actress for both parts. But
yeah, no, fair point.
Yeah.
So the king tells, so the woman, the Rimbaud agrees begrudgingly to let the king have his way with her. He says, mm-hmm. be at my chambers at midnight.
Yes.
Don't wear anything complicated.
You know, again, that's like half an absurd joke, half kind of creepy.
Yeah, a little bit.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I would probably grade this more on a curve if I'd watched it as a kid. But I'm not watching it as a kid. I'm watching it as a grown man in 2026. So
It's a little like, oh,
yeah, I'm sorry, a little like, eh. So the king goes back to his chambers, and Harvey Korman's character, Count de Monet, says, "Like, sir, the peasants are revolting."
you said it.
Yeah,
they stink.
And he basically explains that like a revolution is brewing, and they have to make preparations for this. And the king's like, "Oh no, but I'm great to the peasants." And then he's literally using the peasants for a skeet shoot. He's launching the peasants into the air and shooting them in midair. Which again, I like that gag because it's a very cartoony gag. So
yeah, see exactly, it's things like that. That was
that
was funny. It's like it's. You know, they play it up absurdly, so it's, you know, you can laugh at it.
It pushes it into the realm of absurd, and you know, which can be a tough thing to do when you're talking about like actual historical atrocities and stuff like that. So
For sure. So at this point, that's where the count comes up with the idea of saying, "Well, we need to get you out of Paris, and we can put somebody in your place, so that when the revolution does happen, they, you know, behead this nobody instead of you."
Right,
and that's when he points out, hey, the piss boy, he looks like you. We can just make him up, and like he'll take the heat once the revolution happens.
Yeah, so we're going like Count of Monte Cristo, Man in the Iron Mask, Prince and the Pauper, sort of thing. And there's always conveniently a double for the super important rich dude that has to be doubled. So
I hear you. So then they make up the piss boy Jacques to look like the king. I think at this point it seems like at this point the king actually already fled Paris.
They're a little vague on that. But all he has to do is like, you know, get a fake mustache and then the beauty mark and then the, you know, proper wigs and clothing, and then he's a double for himself.
Yes, absolutely. So so at this point you know, the piss boy is like kind of freaking out. It's like, why do you need to make me look like the king? I can't do it. I can't walk in these heels. And then the count explains the plan to him about how, they're probably just going to, when the revolution comes, the people are just going to behead you so the king is safe. And he freaks out even more. We see that Rimbaud shows up to the king's chambers ready to be ravaged.
She's like, you know, just get it over with. Like Count de Monet opens the door and she's like already like ripping her bodice open.
Right. Right. And at this point, the piss boy is like in another room and the count tries to ravage her. He ends up falling off a balcony.
He wants her for himself, but like, I didn't feel like that plot really quite went anywhere. It was just like, it's just a thing that happens in the scene and it doesn't really come back. I don't know. There's no rivalry or no complications that arise from that. So I was like, why is this in here? Other than just, you know, Pamela Stevenson is very attractive.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I thought I was watching Baywatch for a minute.
Not all Pamela's. Just.
I was like, why isn't anybody in a red swimsuit in this? Why aren't we rescuing drowning victims? What's going on?
Where's David Chokichi?
I love that you pulled Chokichi instead of Hasselhoff.
It's funnier. Why I said it.
Chokichi. It's got that K sound. Yeah. K's are funny.
Yeah. There you
but
go.
But Hasselhoff, see? Also a funny name. Yeah.
So. It is, but I fear Chokichi was like, no, that'll put it over the edge.
Chokichi is, it's funnier sounding, and it's a deeper pull, so it's funnier that way. So, yeah.
Bam! That's why I'm a pro.
That's right.
So. I also couldn't notice how the bedroom, the king's quarters, mm-hmm. like, looks a lot like the current White House, but that's something else for another.
Oh, edition. Yeah, all that gold detailing. I flashed on that too. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's white and it's like all very ornate to the point of being tacky.
This is what he's going for. He's going for this look. Sorry. I didn't mean to bring the podcast down.
No. I was thinking of something, but it's something that I can't say because I don't want to visit from the Secret Service. So.
Oh, shit. Oh. Wow. Wow. Ooh.
You know, there are guillotines in this movie later on. That's just a random thought that came into my head.
Okay, guys, sign up for Patreon if you want to hear more of John's thoughts. That's right. Show us the Monet, and we'll tell you all these dark thoughts we've had. So now we're at the point where the Rimbaud meets the piss boy, Jacques. Mm-hmm. And of course she thinks he's the king.
Right.
And, you know, of course he doesn't want to ravish her like that. And he just agrees.
Yeah, because he's a decent person. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's a decent human being. Ruled by his Peter. Yeah. So he agrees to pardon his father and doesn't have to sleep with her or anything. And
her father.
Her father. Jeez, why do you keep saying that?
You're having problems with pronouns this week, buddy.
I guess so. I am so sorry. I'm the problem. So he looks through the desk. He sees nothing but execution papers. He finds one pardon.
Right.
He signs it, and it's like, all right, give this to the jailers in the prison, and it'll free your father. She does that. The father is freed of all charges. He's happy to be freed. And then he lets all his... the birds he have in cages around his prison free.
It's like a Birdman of Alcatraz type of thing, I think they were going for. Yeah,
exactly. But all the birds are dead, so as he's putting them out towards the window, you're free, they're just falling straight to the
ground. Right now. Yeah, that was cute.
Cute guy. So at this point, the revolution has begun. Mm-hmm. The poor are storming the palace. Rimbaud and her father are running back into the king's quarters to... I'm not sure why. They went back to him, I guess, to protect him because he's just such a... He was so nice to them. I guess they feel like an allegiance. So then this is where the angry mob storms the chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see Cloris Leachman saying in the name of the people of France. Of course, somebody corrects her. It says France.
Yeah.
France. And yeah, they take him away to be arrested, to be beheaded. And of course, all this time, the piss boy is saying, I'm not the king. But they don't believe him. So now we're up at the guillotine. He tries to,
tries to
be brave.
Yeah, and he says, I may not have been born a king or lived like a king, but I can die like a king. So, you know, it's a nice moment of nobility there. And then, of course, he like immediately chickens out when he sees like what the guillotine does. They're like, "Let's test the guillotine," and they put like a melon in there. And he's like, "Oh yeah, no."
Like, "Holy shit!"
yeah. And they ask him for like some last request. He's like, "Could I have some Novocaine?" And they're like, it's 1789. That doesn't exist yet." And he's like, "I can wait for it to be invented."
He tells the crowd that he's not the king. They say, "Bullshit."
Yeah.
So they put him in the guillotine, and then you can hear Rimbaud say, well, only a miracle can save him now.
Right.
And Josephus and the horse Miracle from the previous scene
from the Roman Empire sequence. So.
From the Roman Empire, they ride up and save the king and the Rimbaud, and they all escape.
Yeah.
So from a different era, he comes up. And
hundreds of years before.
Yeah.
And I liked the randomness of that, and it did help sort of tie the movie together a bit more, because it's unavoidably like very episodic.
Right. Yeah. And as they escape, I think Jock says, hey, how are you able to travel through time and save us? And Joseph says, hey, baby, movies is magic.
Yeah. And also, that seems to be a very Mel Brooks thing. He loves making jokes about, you know, people out of time. Because, like, the ending of Blazing Saddles famously has them basically invading the premiere of their own movie. Yeah. So suddenly they're in the 20th century. So,
yeah, he likes to do things like that.
Yeah.
And then as they're escaping and driving off into the distance, the king or Jock says, oh, we better kiss soon. It looks like we're coming to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to kiss Rimbaud, but he ends up Pamela Stevenson, but he ends up kissing
Gregory Hines. Yeah.
Gregory Hines. And then he kisses Rimbaud, and then that's when we see that they have indeed come to the end, because on the side of a mountain carved in it says the end.
The giant map painting with, you know, in the style of like the titles you used to see on all those 50 epics, like Ben-Hur or King of Kings or whatever. And it just says the end in huge letters. Cute gag.
Yeah. But you think it's the end, but it's not because they show some trailers for coming soon. History of the World Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get a few quick little gags. We get a, you know, say, come and see Hitler on Ice, where we see Hitler ice skating. Hitler,
just doing pirouettes on the ice.
A Viking funeral,
mm-hmm.
where we see these bearded men with horned helmets. At one point, they take off their helmets, put it over their hearts, and we see that they still actually have the horns.
Yeah, the horns are, like, coming out of their heads. They're not part of their helmets. So
right. And then we get Jews in Space, where these rabbis are in outer space with these spaceships that look like the Star of David,
mm-hmm.
you know, zooming along, protecting the Hebrew race.
Yeah. And it's the tune of Jews in Space. He later reused that for Robin Hood Men in Tights.
I thought that sounded familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea when I saw Robin Hood Men in Tights that it was like the same tune, but okay, you know, hey, you rip off from yourself and then you're stealing from the best.
Yeah, it's fine if you do rip off yourself. That's cool.
Yeah. The Jews in Space sequence is kind of funny. Again, I felt like it was like maybe there was a bit of a Python influence, because like Michael Bryan famously has that bit where Bryan falls off a tower and he's like picked up by the alien spaceship and then it crashes to Earth and then just, and it's never commented on at all. It's just this weird random thing that happens in the middle of the movie. So maybe. I mean, and he was at least friendly enough with John Cleese to have him, you know, to cast him in the movie before Cleese pulled out for scheduling conflicts. So I wonder how much Life of Brian might have been in his mind when he was doing this.
Might have been quite a bit. Yeah. Like, now that you mentioned, there is a lot of stuff that kind of does remind me of Python and had the same Python vibes, but it was just like told through a Mel Brooks lens, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And then that's the movie, History of the World Part 1. Yeah, a lot of it I didn't remember, some of it I vaguely remember, but overall I enjoyed this film. I thought it was pretty fantastic. I mean, a lot of it is I don't know how it would go over well with modern audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, a lot of modern audiences like a lot of Trey Parker, Matt Stone stuff. So maybe some of it would be okay. Some of it would be like, I don't know about this. But overall, a lot of good gags, some solid laughs.
Yeah, I
dug it.
I think I like the movie more than I disliked it. It's still, I'm like just on the cusp, because there aren't quite as many like classic gags as I think. And I'm sort of maybe unfairly judging it against Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles, because those are like the pinnacle Mel Brooks for me. So I watched this and I was like, yeah, there's some good stuff in there, but I'm a little mixed on it. But I like it more than I dislike it.
Yeah, all right, I agree. I mean, you know, the Ten Commandments joke is a solid gag. Mm-hmm. You know, it has it's good to be the king line.
Yeah.
Spanish Inquisition, I think, is a banger.
Yeah.
I think the French Revolution, that might have been the weakest of the bunch, but there's still enough in there for it to be okay.
Yeah. And I guess we should note that a few years ago on Hulu, they actually did make History of the World Part 2. So it was a limited television series we had Mel Brooks, Wanda Sykes, Nick Kroll, Ike Barinholtz, and David Stassen, who I think I'm familiar with. But they did that. I, of course, haven't watched that because I hadn't seen the original film, so I didn't. Did you see any of the sequel series?
No, I did not see it. Okay. I've heard it's okay. I mean, I've heard mm-hmm. I've heard good things about it, but yeah, still, for whatever reason, I just haven't felt the need to see it.
You know what? I'm looking at its Wikipedia page right now. Yeah. We got Fred Armisen and Rob Riggle are both in it, so it could qualify. We could tackle History of the World Part 2 at some point. I have no idea how many hours it is overall. So okay. it's 8 episodes, so that's a lot.
Okay. But like a half hour each, I guess.
Probably something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Running time 29 to 31 minutes. So that's 8 episodes. So that's, that's like 4 hours. Okay. Yeah. That's doable.
Yeah. Maybe.
Maybe we'll do History of the World Part 2 at some point and check it out.
Maybe. So, it's a long summer. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll do something like that. But yeah, overall, solid movie. Glad we watched it.
Yeah. I was glad that I finally got to see the entire thing. Yes. After only knowing bits and pieces from it. I just kind of knew what I knew through cultural osmosis. But
Fine. Have you now completed the whole Mel Brooks oeuvre? Is there any other Mel Brooks movies you haven't seen? I don't think I've seen High Anxiety, now that I really think about it.
I'm not sure if I've seen High Anxiety all the way through. I know I haven't seen Life Stinks. That was something from the 90s. I know I haven't seen Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't see that because I just heard so many like meh things about it. Yeah. I remember that coming up. Everybody yeah. like, because it's like a thing where, like, I think I remember, I forget where I heard it, but like where, like from the Police Squad and Naked Gun, when Leslie Nielsen wasn't trying to be funny, he was funny. Mm-hmm. And then, like, Dracula Dead and Loving It, he's trying to be funny, and it's not funny.
There was a moment in this film where they were doing that thing where they have a gag line, and then a couple characters are, like, doing the double take for a minute, and they're like, hey, what was that weird thing that they just said? And I was like, oh, I hope they don't do that to excess in this movie, because that was what started killing, like, the Airplane and the Naked Gun movies for me.
Yeah.
The Naked Gun movies in particular, because, like, it was just, like, you know, have an absurd gag and then have 30 seconds of Leslie Nielsen mugging. And it's like, no, this is so much funnier when you just do a deadpan and straight laced and nobody comments on the absurdity. That's the secret to me.
Yeah.
Let's see. Have you seen, I don't think I've seen Silent Movie. That's another Mel Brooks movie.
I haven't seen that either.
Yeah. That's one of his ones from the 70s. So I've seen like the super famous ones, the top tier Mel Brooks, the Spaceballs, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, Producers.
Yeah. Creme de la creme.
And also Robin Hood Mennonites. Which,
of course. Of course. Creme de la creme.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he hasn't directed as many films as I realized.
Yeah. Okay, but History of the World Part 1, I'd recommend it. I'd say you guys should check it out. And that's our episode, guys. Thanks for listening to the podcast. As always, you could follow us on the Blue Skies at SNL Nerds. You can listen to this madness on our YouTube page. Donate to our Patreon, non-productive.com. And you can follow me, myself, and I on all the socials at Darren Credible, D-A-R-I-N, Credible.
And you can follow me on all the socials at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L and the word comic. And yeah, if you're going on our YouTube page, the entire archive of the podcast is up on there. So, you know, you can find us commenting on all episodes of SNL from the last 8 seasons.
Oh,
can you believe it? And just like, and all the movies that we've covered on the off weeks and the summer hiatus, and you know, just poke around. I'm sure you'll find something you like there. So
you'll find something for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So just go to non-productive on YouTube and you can find the entire archive and whole playlist of us there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah, and we're going to, well, should we say what we're doing next week? We kind of discussed this before we started recording.
Yeah. And do you want to go ahead and say it? Yeah, let's say it. Why not?
Yeah. Well, okay. So we really enjoyed revisiting Mel Brooks for this. And we put up a choice for people, like, should we do the producers, the musical, the movie musical version of the producers from 2005, I think it was, or should we do History of the World Part 1? And more people said, yeah, do History of the World Part 1. But we still want to do the producers. So we're going to continue on this Mel Brooks train, and we're going to do the producers next week.
There you go. Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick, Will Ferrell, Uma Thurman.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it.
We're doing it. And yeah, lots of people from the stage version, which I was lucky enough to see back in the day. So I can talk about that next week. Okay. Yeah. Looking forward to that. Yeah. So, okay. And I'm sure we'll have some stuff to relate to the present day times.
Yes.
Yes.
Sadly, but yes.
All right, so that's next week on the SNL Nerds. Join us for the producers. But until then, Nerds out! Yeah!
Ah!
Ah! Okay.
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.